Eslidale. I saw a programme. It had David Attenborough, so it's true. The other them looked at Adam. It was like watching a tennis match. The hollow earth theory was not going over well in the quarry. A beguiling idea that had stood up to the probings of such remarkable thinkers as Cyrus Reid Tweed, Bulwer Lytton, and Adolf Hitler was bending dangerously in the wind of Wensleydale's searingly bespectacled logic.
"I didn't say it was hollow all the way through," said Adam. "No one said it was hollow all the way through. It probably goes down miles and miles to make room for all the lather and oil and coal and Tibetan tunnels and such like. But then it's hollow after that. That's what people think. And there's a hole at the North Pole to let the air in."
"Never seen it on an atlas," sniffed Wensleydale.
"The government won't let them put it on a map in case people go and have a look in," said Adam. "The reason being, the people living inside don't want people looking down on them all the time."
"What do you mean, Tibetan tunnels?" said Pepper. "You said Tibetan tunnels."
"Ah, didn't I tell you about them?" Three heads shook. "It's amazing. You know Tibet?" They nodded doubtfully. A series of images had risen in their minds. Yaks, Mount Everest, people called Grasshopper, little old men sitting on mountains, other people learning kung fu in ancient temples, and snow.
"Well, you know all those teachers that left Atlantis when it sunk?"
They nodded again.
"Well, some of them went to Tibet, and now they run the world. They're called the Secret Masters, on account of being teachers, I suppose. And they've got this secret underground city called Shambhala, and tunnels that go all over the world so's they know everything that goes on and control everything. Some people reckon that they really live under the Gobi Desert," he added loftily. "But most competent authorities reckon it's Tibet all right. Better for the tunnelling, anyway."
The them instinctively looked down at the grubby, dirt-covered chalk beneath their feet.
"How come they know everything?" said Pepper.
"Well, they just have to listen, right?" hazarded Adam. "They just have to sit in their tunnels and listen. You know what hearing teachers have? They can hear a whisper right across the room."
"My granny used to put a glass against the wall," said Brian. "She said it was disgusting the way she could hear everything that went on next door." "And these tunnels go everywhere, do they?" said Pepper, still staring at the ground.
"All over the world," said Adam firmly.
"Must have took a long time," said Pepper, doubtfully. "You remember when we tried digging that tunnel out in the field, we were at it all afternoon, and you had to scrunch up to get all in."
"Yes, but they've been doing it for millions of years. You can do really good tunnels if you've got millions of years."
"I thought the Tibetans were conquered by the Chinese, and the Dalai Lama had to go to India," said Wensleydale,
but without much conviction. Wensleydale read his father's newspaper every evening, but the prosaic everydayness of the world always seemed to melt under the powerhouse of Adam's explanations.
"I bet they're down there now," said Adam, ignoring this. "They'd be all over the place by now, sitting underground and listening."
They looked at one another.
"If we dug down quickly," said Brian.
Pepper, who was a lot quicker on the uptake, groaned.
"What did you go and have to say that for?" said Adam. "Fat lot of good us trying to surprise them now, isn't it? With you shouting out something like that.
I was just thinking we could dig down, and you just have to go and warn them."
"I don't think they dig all those tunnels," said Wensleydale doggedly. "It doesn't make any sense. Tibet's hundreds of miles away."
"Oh, yes. Oh, yes. And I suppose you know more about it than Madame Blatvatatatsky," sniffed Adam.
"Now, if I was a Tibetan," said Wensleydale, in a reasonable tone of voice, "I'd just dig straight down to the hollow bit in the middle, and then run around the inside, and dig straight up where I wanted to be."
They gave this due consideration.
"You've got to admit that's more sensible than tunnels," said Pepper.
"Yes, well, I expect that's what they do," said Adam. "They'd be bound to have thought of something as simple as that."
Brian stared dreamily at the sky while his finger probed the contents of one ear.
"Funny, really,"
he said. You spend your whole life going to school and learning stuff, and they never tell you about stuff like the Bermuda Triangle and UFOs and all these old masters running around the inside of the Earth. Why do we have to learn boring stuff when there's all this brilliant stuff we could be learning? That's what I want to know.
There was a chorus of agreement. Then they went out and played Charles Fort and the Atlantisans versus the ancient masters of Tibet. But the Tibetans claimed that using mystic ancient lasers was cheating. There was a time when witchfinders were respected, although it didn't last very long. Matthew Hopkins, for example, the witchfinder general, found witches all over the east of England in the middle of the 17th century, charging each town and village ninepence a witch for everyone he discovered. That was the trouble. Witchfinders didn't get paid by the hour. Any witchfinder who spent a week examining the local crones and then told the mayor, "Well done, not a pointy hat among the lot of them," would get fulsome thanks, a bowl of soup, and a meaningful goodbye. So, in order to turn a profit, Hopkins had to find a remarkable number of witches. This made him more than a little unpopular with the village councils, and he was himself hanged as a witch by an East Anglian village who had sensibly realized that they could cut their overheads by eliminating the middleman. It is thought by many that Hopkins was the last witchfinder general. In this, they would, strictly speaking, be correct. Possibly not in the way they imagine, however. The witchfinder army marched on, just slightly more quietly. There is no longer a real witchfinder general. Nor is there a witchfinder colonel, a witchfinder major, a witchfinder captain, or even a witchfinder lieutenant. The last one was killed falling out of a very tall tree in Caterham in 1933 while attempting to get a better view of something he believed was a satanic orgy of the most degenerate persuasion, but was in fact the Caterham and Whiteleaf Market Traders Association annual dinner and dance. There is, however, a witchfinder sergeant. There is also, now, a witchfinder private. His name is Newton Pulsifer. It was the advertisement that got him in the Gazette, between a fridge for sale and a litter of not exactly Dalmatians. Join the professionals, part-time. Assistant required to combat the forces of darkness. Uniform, basic training provided. Field promotion certain. Be a man. In his lunch hour, he phoned the number at the bottom of the ad. A woman answered. Hello? He began, tentatively. I saw your advert.
Oh, which one, love?
The one in the paper.
Right, love. Well, Madame Tracy draws aside the veil every afternoon except Thursdays. Party's welcome. When would you be wanting to explore the mysteries, love?
Newton hesitated.
Well, the advert says, join the professionals, he said. It didn't mention Madame Tracy.
Oh, that'll be Mr. Shadwell you'll be wanting, then. Just a sec. I'll see if he's in.
Later, when he was on nodding terms with Madame Tracy, Newt learned that if he had mentioned the other ad, the one in the magazine, Madame Tracy would have been available for strict discipline and intimate massage every evening except Thursdays. There was yet another ad in a phone box somewhere. When, much later, Newt asked her what this one involved, she said, Thursdays. Eventually, there was the sound of feet in uncarpeted hallways, a deep coughing, and a voice the colour of an old raincoat rumbled,
Aye.
Oh, I read your advert. Join the professionals. I wanted to know a bit more about it.
Aye, there's many as would like to know more about it, and there's many...
The voice trailed off impressively, then crashed back to full volume.
There's many as wouldn't.
Oh?
Squeaked Newton.
What's your name, lad?
Newton. Newton Pulsifer.
Lucifer, was that you say? Are ye of the spawn of darkness, a tempting beguiling creature from the pit, wanton limbs steaming from the flesh parts of Hades, in tortured and lubricious thrall to your Stygian and hellish masters?
That's Pulsifer,
explained Newton. With a P. I don't know about the other stuff, but we come from Surrey. The voice on the phone sounded vaguely disappointed.
Oh, aye. Well then, Pulsifer. Pulsifer. I've seen that name afore, maybe.
I don't know, said Newton. My uncle runs a toy shop in Hounslow, he added, in case this was any help.
Is that so? Said Shadwell.
Mr. Shadwell's accent was unplaceable. It careered around Britain like a milk race. Here a mad Welsh drill sergeant, there a High Kirk elder who'd just seen someone doing something on a Sunday. Somewhere between them, a dour Daleland shepherd, or bitter Somerset miser. It didn't matter where the accent went, it didn't get any nicer.
Have ye all your own teeth?
Oh, yes, except for fillings.
Are ye fit?
I suppose so, Newt stuttered. I mean, that was why I wanted to join the Territorials. Brian Potter in accounting can bench press almost 100 since he joined. And he paraded in front of the Queen Mother.
How many nipples?
Pardon?
Nipples, laddie, nipples, said the voice testily. How many nipples have you got?
Two?
Good. Have you got your own scissors?
What?
Scissors! Scissors, are you deaf?
No, yes, I mean, I've got some scissors. I'm not deaf.
The cocoa had nearly all solidified. Green fur was growing on the inside of the mug. There was a thin layer of dust on a xerophile, too. The stack of notes was building up beside him. The nice and accurate prophecies was a mass of improvised bookmarks made of torn strips of Daily Telegraph. Aziraphale stirred and pinched his nose. He was nearly there. He got the shape of it. He'd never met Agnes. She was too bright, obviously. Normally heaven or hell spotted the prophetic types and broadcast enough noises on the same mental channel to prevent any undue accuracy. Actually, that was rarely necessary. They normally found ways of generating their own static in self-defense against the images that echoed around their heads. Poor old St. John had his mushrooms, for example. Mother Shipton had her ale. Nostradamus had his collection of interesting oriental preparations. St. Malachi had his still. Good old Malachi. He'd been a nice old boy, sitting there dreaming about future popes. Complete piss artist, of course. Could have been a real thinker, if it hadn't been for the Pachin. A sad end. Sometimes you really had to hope that the ineffable plan had been properly thought out. Thought. There was something he had to do. Oh, yes. Phone his contact. Get things sorted out. He stood up, stretched his limbs, and made a phone call. Then he thought, why not? Worth a try. He went back and shuffled through his sheaf of notes. Agnes really had been good and clever. No one was interested in accurate prophecies. Paper in hand, he phoned directory inquiries. Hello, good afternoon, so kind. Yes, this will be a Tadfield number, I think, or lower Tadfield. Ah, or possibly Norton. I'm not sure of the precise code. Yes. Young. Name of Young. Sorry, no initial. Oh, well, can you give me all of them? Thank you. Back on the table, a pencil picked itself up and scribbled furiously. At the third name, it broke its point.
Ah, said Aziraphale, his mouth suddenly running on automatic while his mind exploded.
I think that's the one. Thank you, so kind. Good day to you.
He hung up almost reverentially, took a few deep breaths, and dialed again. The last three digits gave him some trouble because his hand was shaking. He listened to the ringing tone. Then a voice answered. It was a middle-aged voice, not unfriendly, but probably it had been having a nap and was not feeling at its best. It said, Tadfield 666. Aziraphale's hand started to shake. Hello, said the receiver. Hello. Aziraphale got a grip on himself.
Sorry, he said. Right number.
He replaced the receiver. Newt wasn't deaf, and he did have his own scissors. He also had a huge pile of newspapers. If he had known that army life consisted chiefly of applying the one to the other, he used to muse, he would never have joined. Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell had made him a list which was taped to the wall in Shadwell's tiny, crowded flat, situated over Rajit's newsagents and video rental. The list read, 1. Witches. 2. Unexplainable phenomenons. Phenomenatrices. Phenomenis. Things, ye ken well what I mean. Newt was looking for either. He sighed and picked up another newspaper, scanned the front page, opened it, ignored page 2, never anything on there, then blushed crimson as he performed the obligatory nipple count on page 3. Shadwell had been insistent about this.
You can't trust them, the cunning buggers, he said. It'd be just like them to come right out in the open, like, defying us.
A couple in black turtleneck sweaters glowered at the camera on page 9. They claimed to lead the largest coven in Saffron Walden, and to restore sexual potency by the use of small and very phallic dolls. The newspaper was offering 10 of the dolls to readers who were prepared to write my most embarrassing moment of impotency stories. Newt cut the story out and stuck it into a scrapbook. There was a muffled thumping on the door. Newt opened it. A pile of newspapers stood there.
Shift yourself, private pulsifer, it barked,
and it shuffled into the room. The newspapers fell to the floor, revealing Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell, who coughed painfully and relit his cigarette, which had gone out.
You want to watch him? He's one of them, he said.
Who, sir?
Take your ease, private. Him, that little brown fella. Mr. So-called Rajit. It's them terrible foreign arts. The ruby-squinted eye of the little yellow god. Women with too many arms. Witches, the lot of them.
He does give us the newspapers free, though, Sergeant, said Newt. And they're not too old.
And voodoo. I bet he does voodoo, sacrificing chickens to that barren Saturday. You know, tall darky bugger in the top hat. Brings people back from the dead, aye, and makes them work on the Sabbath day. Voodoo.
Shadwell sniffed speculatively. Newt tried to picture Shadwell's landlord as an exponent of voodoo. Certainly Mr. Rajit worked on the Sabbath. In fact, with his plump, quiet wife and plump, cheerful children, he worked around the clock, never mind the calendar, diligently filling the area's needs in the matter of soft drinks, white bread, tobacco, sweets, newspapers, magazines, and the type of top-shelf pornography that made Newt's eyes water just to think about. The worst you could imagine Mr. Rajit doing with a chicken was selling it after the sell-by date.
But Mr. Rajit's from Bangladesh or India or somewhere, he said. I thought voodoo came from the West Indies.
Ah, said Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell,
and took another drag on his cigarette. Or appeared to. Newt had never actually quite seen one of his superior's cigarettes. It was something to do with the way he cupped his hands. He even made the ends disappear when he'd finished with them.
Ah.
Well, doesn't it?
Hidden wisdom, lad. Inner military secrets of the Witchfinder Army. When you're all initiated proper, you'll know the secret truth. Some voodoo may come from the West Indies, I'll grant you that. Oh, yes, I'll grant you that. But the worst kind, the darkest kind, that comes from,
Bangladesh.
Ah, yes, lad, that's it. Words right out of me mouth. Bangladesh, exactly.
Shadwell made the end of his cigarette vanish and managed furtively to roll another, never letting papers or tobacco be seen.
So, you got anything, Witchfinder Private?
Well, there's this.
Newton held out the clipping. Shadwell squinted at it.
Oh, them, he said. Load of rubbish. call themselves bloody witches. I checked them out last year. Went down with me armory of righteousness and a packet of firelighters, jemmied the place open. They were clean as a whistle. Mail-order bee-jelly business they're trying to pep up. Load of rubbish. Wouldn't know a familiar spirit if it chewed out the bottoms of their trousers. Rubbish. It's not like it used to be, laddie.
He sat down and poured himself a cup of sweet tea from a filthy thermos.
Did I ever tell you how I was recruited to the army? He asked.
Newt took this as his cue to sit down. He shook his head. Shadwell lit his roll-up with a battered Ronson lighter and coughed appreciatively.
My cellmate, he was. Witchfinder Captain Foulkes. 10 years for arson. Burning a coven in Wimbledon. Would have got him all, too, if it wasn't the wrong day. A good fellow. Told me about the battle. The great war between heaven and hell. It was him that told me the inner secrets of the Witchfinder army. Familiar spirits. Nipples. All that. Knew he was dying, you see. Got to have someone to carry on the tradition. Like you is now.
He shook his head.
That's what we'm reduced to, lad, he said. A few hundred years ago, see, we was powerful. We stood between the world and the darkness. We was the thin red line. Thin red line of fire, you see.
I thought the churches... Newt began.
Pah!
Said Shadwell. Newt had seen the word in print, but this was the first time he'd ever heard anyone say it.
Churches? What good did they ever do? They're just as bad. Same line of business, nearly. You can't trust them to stamp out the evil one, because if they did, they'd be out of that line of business. If you're going up against a tiger, you don't want fellow travellers whose idea of hunting is to throw meat at it. Nay, lad, it's up to us. Against the darkness.
Everything went quiet for a moment. Newt always tried to see the best in everyone, but it had occurred to him shortly after joining the WA that his superior and only fellow soldier was as well balanced as an upturned pyramid. Shortly, in this case, meant under 5 seconds. The WA's headquarters was a fetid room with walls the colour of nicotine, which was almost certainly what they were coated with, and a floor the colour of cigarette ash, which was almost certainly what it was. There was a small square of carpet. Newt avoided walking on it, if possible, because it sucked at his shoes. One of the walls had a yellowing map of the British Isles tacked to it, with homemade flags sticking in it here and there. Most of them were within a cheap day return fare of London. But Newt had stuck with it the past few weeks because, well, horrified fascination had turned into horrified pity, and then a sort of horrified affection. Shadwell had turned out to be about 5 feet high and wore clothes which, no matter what they actually were, always turned up, even in your short-term memory, as an old Macintosh. The old man may have had all his own teeth, but only because no one else could possibly have wanted them. Just one of them, placed under the pillow, would have made the tooth fairy hand in its wand. He appeared to live entirely on sweet tea, condensed milk, hand-rolled cigarettes, and a sort of sullen internal energy. Shadwell had a cause, which he followed with the full resources of his soul and his pensioner's concessionary travel pass. He believed in it. It powered him like a turbine. Newton Pulsifer had never had a cause in his life, nor had he, as far as he knew, ever believed in anything. It had been embarrassing, because he quite wanted to believe in something, since he recognized that belief was the lifebelt that got most people through the choppy waters of life. He'd have liked to believe in a supreme god, although he'd have preferred a half-hour's chat with him before committing himself to clear up one or two points. He'd sat in all sorts of churches, waiting for that single flash of blue light, and it hadn't come. And then he'd tried to become an official atheist, and hadn't got the rock-hard, self-satisfied strength of belief even for that. And every single political party had seemed to him equally dishonest. and he'd given up on ecology when the ecology magazine he'd been subscribing to had shown its readers a plan of a self-sufficient garden and had drawn the ecological goat tethered within 3 feet of the ecological beehive. Newt had spent a lot of time at his grandmother's house in the country and thought he knew something about the habits of both goats and bees, and concluded, therefore, that the magazine was run by a bunch of bib-overalled maniacs. Besides, it used the word community too often. Newt had always suspected that people who regularly used the word community were using it in a very specific sense that excluded him and everyone he knew. Then he'd tried believing in the universe, which seemed sound enough, until he'd innocently started reading new books with words like chaos and time and quantum in the titles. He'd found that even the people whose job of work was, so to speak, the universe, didn't really believe in it, and were actually quite proud of not knowing what it really was, or even if it could theoretically exist. To Newt's straightforward mind, this was intolerable. Newt had not believed in the Cub Scouts, and then, when he was old enough, not in the Scouts either. He was prepared to believe, though, that the job of wages clerk at United Holdings, Holdings, PLC, was possibly the most boring in the world. This is how Newton Pulsifer looked as a man. If he went into a phone booth and changed, he might manage to come out looking like Clark Kent. But he found he rather liked Shadwell. People often did, much to Shadwell's annoyance. The Rajits liked him because he always eventually paid his rent and didn't cause any trouble, and was racist in such a glowering, undirected way that it was quite inoffensive. It was simply that Shadwell hated everyone in the world, regardless of caste, colour or creed, and wasn't going to make any exceptions for anyone. Madame Tracy liked him. Newt had been amazed to find that the tenant of the other flat was a middle-aged, motherly soul, whose gentlemen callers called as much for a cup of tea and a nice chat as for what little discipline she was still able to exact. Sometimes, when he'd nursed a half-pint of Guinness on a Saturday night, Shadwell would stand in the corridor between their rooms and shout things like, "Hood of Babylon!" But she told Newt privately that she'd always felt rather gratified about this, even though the closest she'd been to Babylon was Torremolinos. It was like free advertising, she said. She said she didn't mind him banging on the wall and swearing during her séance afternoons either. Her knees had been giving her jip, and she wasn't always up to operating the table wrapper, she said, so a bit of muffled thumping came in useful. On Sundays, she'd leave him a bit of dinner on his doorstep, with another plate over the top of it to keep it warm. You couldn't help liking Shadwell, she said. For all the good it did, though, she might as well be flicking bread pellets into a black hole. Newt remembered the other cuttings. He pushed them across the stained desk.
What are these? Said Shadwell suspiciously.
Phenomena, said Newt. You said to look for phenomena. There's more phenomena than witches these days, I'm afraid.
Anyone been shooting hares with a silver bullet and next day an old crone in the village is walking with a limp? Shadwell said, hopefully.
I'm afraid not.
Any cows dropping dead after some woman has looked at them?
No.
What is it, then? Said Shadwell.
He shuffled across to the sticky brown cupboard and pulled out a tin of condensed milk.
Odd things happening, said Newt. He'd spent weeks on this. Shadwell had really let the papers pile up. Some of them went back for years. Newt had quite a good memory, perhaps because in his 23 years, very little had happened to fill it up, and he'd become quite expert on some very esoteric subjects. Seems to be something new every day, said Newt, flicking through the rectangles of newsprint. Something weird has been happening to nuclear power stations, and no one seems to know what it is. And some people are claiming that the lost continent of Atlantis has risen. He looked proud of his efforts. Shadwell's penknife punctured the condensed milk tin. There was the distant sound of a telephone ringing. Both men instinctively ignored it. All the calls were for Madame Tracy anyway, and some of them were not intended for the ear of man. Newt had conscientiously answered the phone on his first day, listened carefully to the question, said, "Marks and Spencer's 100% cotton Y-fronts, actually," and had been left with a dead receiver. Shadwell sucked deeply.
"Ah, that's no proper phenomena," he said. "Can't see any witches doing that. They're more for singular things, you can."
Newt's mouth opened and shut a few times.
"If we're strong in the fight against witchery, we can't afford to be sidetracked by this style of thing," Shadwell went on. "Haven't you got anything more witchcrafty?"
"But American troops have landed on it to protect it from things," moaned Newt. "A non-existent continent."
"Any witches on it?" said Shadwell,
showing a spark of interest for the first time. "It doesn't say," said Newt.
"Ah, then, it's just politics and geography," said Shadwell dismissively.
Madame Tracy poked her head around the door.
"Cooey, Mr. Shadwell," she said, giving Newt a friendly little wave. "A gentleman on the telephone for you." "Oh, hello, Mr. Newton."
"Away with ye, harlot," said Shadwell automatically.
"He sounds ever so refined," said Madame Tracy, taking no notice. "And I'll be getting us a nice bit of liver for Sunday."
"I'd sooner sup with a devil, woman."
"So if you'd let me have the plates back from last week, it'd be a help. There's the love," said Madame Tracy,
and tottered unsteadily back on 3-inch heels to her flat and whatever it was that had been interrupted. Newt looked despondently at his cuttings as Shadwell went out grumbling to the phone. There was one about the stones of Stonehenge moving out of position, as though they were iron filings in a magnetic field. He was vaguely aware of one side of a telephone conversation.
"Ooh? Ah, aye. Oh, you see. What class of thing would that be?" "Aye, just as you say, sir. And where is this place, then?"
But mysteriously moving stones wasn't Shadwell's cup of tea, or rather, tin of milk.
Fine, Shadwell reassured the caller. "We'll get on to it right away. I'll put my best squad on it and report success to you any minute, I have no doubt. Goodbye to you, sir." "And bless you too, sir."
There was the ting of a receiver going back on the hook, and then Shadwell's voice, no longer metaphorically crouched in deference, said,
"Dear boy, you great southern pansy."
Footnote. Shadwell hated all southerners, and by inference, was standing at the North Pole. He shuffled back into the room, and then stared at Newt as if he'd forgotten why he was there.
What was it he was going on about?" he said.
"All these things that are happening," Newt began.
"Aye."
Shadwell continued to look through him while thoughtfully tapping the empty tin against his teeth. "Well, there's this little town which has been having some amazing weather for the last few years," Newt went on helplessly.
"What? Raining frogs and similar?"
said Shadwell, brightening up a bit.
"No, it just has normal weather for the time of year."
"You call that a phenomena?" said Shadwell. "I've seen phenomenas that make your hair curl, laddie."
He started tapping again.
"When do you remember normal weather for the time of year?" said Newt, slightly annoyed. "Normal weather for the time of year isn't normal, Sergeant. It has snow at Christmas. When did you last see snow at Christmas? And long, hot Augusts? Every year? And crisp autumns? The kind of weather you used to dream of as a kid. It never rained on November the 5th, and always snowed on Christmas Eve."
Shadwell's eyes looked unfocused. He paused with the condensed milk tin halfway to his lips.
"I never used to dream when I was a kid," he said quietly.
Newt was aware of skidding around the lip of some deep, unpleasant pit. He mentally backed away.
"It's just very odd," he said. "There's a weatherman here talking about averages and norms and microclimates and things like that."
"What's that mean?" said Shadwell.
"Means he doesn't know why," said Newt, who hadn't spent years on the literal of business without picking up a thing or two.
He looked sidelong at the witchfinder sergeant. "Witches are well known for affecting the weather," he prompted. "I looked it up in the Discovery." "Oh, God," he thought, "or other suitable entity. Don't let me spend another evening cutting newspapers to bits in this ashtray of a room. Let me get out in the fresh air. Let me do whatever is the WA's equivalent of going water skiing in Germany." "It's only 40 miles away," he said, tentatively. "I thought I could just sort of nip over there tomorrow and have a look around, you know. I'll pay my own petrol," he added. Shadwell wiped his upper lip thoughtfully.
"This place," he said, "it wouldn't have been called Tadfield, would it?"
"That's right, Mr. Shadwell," said Newt. "How did you know that?"
"Wonder what the Southerners is playing at now," said Shadwell, under his breath. "Well," he said, out loud, "and why not?"
"Who'll be playing, Sergeant?" said Newt. Shadwell ignored him.
I suppose it can't do any harm. You'll pay your own petrol, you see."
Newt nodded.
"Then you'll come here at 9 o'clock in the morning," he said, "afore you go."
"What for?" said Newt.
"Your armor of righteousness."
Just after Newt had left, the phone rang again. This time it was Crowley, who gave approximately the same instructions as Aziraphale. Shadwell took them down again, for form's sake, while Madame Tracy hovered delightedly behind him.
"Two calls in one day, Mr. Shadwell," she said. "Your little army must be marching away like anything."
"Ach, away with you, you marine-plashed Berezini," muttered Shadwell, and slammed the door. "Tadfield," he thought. "Ach, well, so long as they paid up on time."
Neither Aziraphale or Crowley ran the Witchfinder army, but they both approved of it, or at least knew that it would be approved of by their superiors. So it appeared on the list of Aziraphale's agencies, because it was, well, a Witchfinder army, and you had to support anyone calling themselves Witchfinders, in the same way that the USA had to support anyone calling themselves anti-communist. And it appeared on Crowley's list for the slightly more sophisticated reason that people like Shadwell did the cause of hell no harm at all. Quite the reverse, it was felt. Strictly speaking, Shadwell didn't run the WA either. According to Shadwell's pay ledgers, it was run by Witchfinder General Smith. Under him were Witchfinder Colonels Green and Jones, and Witchfinder Majors Jackson, Robinson, and Smith. No relation. Then there were Witchfinder Majors Saucepan, Tin, Milk, and Cupboard, because Shadwell's limited imagination had been beginning to struggle at this point. And Witchfinder Captains Smith, 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 and Smythe, and Ditto, and 500 Witchfinder Privates and Corporals and Sergeants. Many of them were called Smith, but this didn't matter because neither Crowley nor Aziraphale had ever bothered to read that far. They simply handed over the pay. After all, both lots put together only came to around £60 a year. Shadwell didn't consider this in any way criminal. The army was a sacred trust, and a man had to do something. The old ninepences weren't coming in like they used to. Saturday. It was very early on Saturday morning, on the last day of the world, and the sky was redder than blood. The International Express delivery man rounded the corner at a careful 35 miles an hour, shifted down to second, and pulled up on the grass verge. He got out of the van, and immediately threw himself into a ditch to avoid an oncoming lorry that had barreled around the bend at something well in excess of 80 miles an hour. He got up, picked up his glasses, put them back on, retrieved his parcel and clipboard, brushed the grass and mud from his uniform,
and, as an afterthought, shook his fist at the rapidly diminishing lorry.
"Shouldn't be allowed, bloody lorries. No respect for other road users, what I always say. What I always say is, remember that without a car, son, you're just a pedestrian too."
He climbed down the grassy verge, clambered over a low fence, and found himself beside the River Uck. The International Express delivery man walked along the banks of the river, holding the parcel. Farther down the river bank sat a young man dressed all in white. He was the only person in sight. His hair was white, his skin chalk pale, and he sat and stared up and down the river as if he were admiring the view. He looked like how Victorian romantic poets looked just before the consumption and drug abuse really started to cut it. The International Express man couldn't understand it. I mean, in the old days, and it wasn't that long ago really, there'd been an angler every dozen yards along the bank. Children had played there, courting couples had come to listen to the splish and gurgle of the river, and to hold hands and to get all lovey-dovey in the Sussex sunset. He'd done that with Maud, his missus, before they were married. They'd come here to spoon, and, on one memorable occasion, fork. Times changed, reflected the delivery man. Now, white and brown sculptures of foam and sludge drifted serenely down the river, often covering it for yards at a stretch. And where the surface of the water was visible, it was covered with a molecule-thin petrochemical sheen. There was a loud whirring as a couple of geese, thankful to be back in England again after the long, exhausting flight across the northern Atlantic, landed on the rainbow-slicked water and sank without trace. "Funny old world," thought the delivery man. "Here's the Uck, used to be the prettiest river in this part of the world, and now it's just a glorified industrial sewer. The swans sink to the bottom, and the fishes float on the top. Well, that's progress for you. You can't stop progress." He had reached the man in white. "Excuse me, sir. Party name of Chalky?" The man in white nodded, said nothing. He continued to gaze out at the river, following an impressive sludge and foam sculpture with his eyes. "So beautiful," he whispered. "It's all so damn beautiful." The delivery man found himself temporarily devoid of words. Then his automatic systems cut in.
"Funny old world, isn't it? And no mistake. I mean, you go all over the world delivering, and then here you are practically in your own home, so to speak. I mean, I was born and bred round here, sir, and I've been to the Mediterranean and to Des Moines, and that's in America, sir, and now here I am, and here's your parcel, sir."
Party name of Chalky took the parcel and took the clipboard and signed for the parcel. The pen developed a leak as he did so, and his signature obliterated itself as it was written. It was a long word, and it began with a P, and then there was a splodge, and then it ended in something that might have been Ents, and might have been Ushan.
"Much obliged, sir," said the delivery man.
He walked back along the river, back toward the busy road where he had left his van, trying not to look at the river as he went. Behind him, the man in white opened the parcel. In it was a crown, a circlet of white metal set with diamonds. He gazed at it for some seconds with satisfaction, then put it on. It glinted in the light of the rising sun. Then the tarnish, which had begun to suffuse its silver surface when his fingers touched it, spread to cover it completely, and the crown went black. White stood up. There's one thing you can say for air pollution. You get utterly amazing sunrises. It looked like someone had set fire to the sky, and a careless match would have set fire to the river. But, alas, there was no time for that now. In his mind, he knew where the four of them would be meeting, and when, and he was going to have to hurry to be there by this afternoon. "Perhaps we will set fire to the sky," he thought, and he left that place almost imperceptibly. It was nearly time. The delivery man had left his van on the grass verge by the dual carriageway. He walked around to the driver's side, carefully because other cars and lorries were still rocketing around the bend, reached in through the open window, and took the schedule from the dashboard. Only one more delivery to make, then. He read the instructions on the delivery voucher carefully. He read them again, paying particular attention to the address and the message. The address was one word. Everywhere. Then, with his leaking pen, he wrote a brief note to Maud, his wife. It read simply, "I love you." Then he put the schedule back on the dashboard, looked left, looked right, looked left again, and began to walk purposefully across the road. He was halfway across when a German juggernaut came around the corner, its driver crazed on caffeine, little white pills, and EEC transport regulations. He watched its receding bulk. "Caw," he thought, "that one nearly had me." Then he looked down at the gutter. "Oh," he thought. "Yes," agreed a voice from behind his left shoulder, or at least from behind the memory of his left shoulder. The delivery man turned and looked and saw. At first he couldn't find the words, couldn't find anything, and then the habits of a working lifetime took over, and he said, "Message for you, sir."
"For me?"
"Yes, sir." He wished he still had a throat. He could have swallowed if he still had a throat. "No package, I'm afraid, Mr. Sir. It's a message."
"Deliver it, then."
"It's this, sir. Him. Come and see."
"Finally."
There was a grin on its face, but then, given the face, there couldn't have been anything else.
"Thank you,"
it continued.
"I must commend your devotion to duty."
"Sir?" The late delivery man was falling through a grey mist, and all he could see were two spots of blue that might have been eyes and might have been distant stars.
"Don't think of it as dying," said Death. "Just think of it as leaving early to avoid the rush."
The delivery man had a brief moment to wonder whether his new companion was making a joke, and to decide that he wasn't, and then there was nothing. Red sky in the morning. It was going to rain. Yes. Witchfinder Sergeant Shadwell stood back with his head on one side.
"Right then," he said. "Y'all ready? Have you got it all?"
"Yes, sir."
"Pendulum of discovery?"
"Pendulum of discovery, yes."
"Thumbscrew?"
Newt swallowed and patted a pocket. "Thumbscrew," he said.
"Firelighters?"
I really think, Sergeant, that
firelighters...
"Firelighters," said Newt sadly. "And matches." Footnote. Note for Americans and other city-dwelling life forms. The rural British, having eschewed central heating as being far too complicated, and in any case weakening moral fibre, prefer a system of piling small pieces of wood and lumps of coal, topped by large wet logs, possibly made of asbestos, into small smouldering heaps, known as, "There's nothing like a roaring open fire, is there?" Since none of these ingredients are naturally inclined to burn, underneath all this, they apply a small rectangular waxy white lump, which burns cheerfully until the weight of the fire puts it out. These little white blocks are called firelighters. No one knows why.
"Bell, book and candle?"
Newt patted another pocket. It contained a paper bag, inside which was a small bell of the sort that maddens budgerigars, a pink candle of the birthday cake persuasion, and a tiny book called Prayers for Little Hands. Shadwell had impressed upon him that although witches were the primary target, a good witchfinder should never pass up the chance to do a quick exorcism, and should have his field kit with him at all times. "Bell, book and candle," said Newt.
"Pin?"
"Pin."
"Good lad, never forget your pin. It's the bayonet in your artillery of light."
Shadwell stood back. Newt noticed with amazement that the old man's eyes had misted over.
"I wish I was going with ye," he said. "Of course, this won't be anything, but it'd be good to get out and about again. It's a trying life, ye ken, all this lying in the wet bracken and spying on their devilish dancing. It gets into your bones, something cruel."
He straightened up and saluted.
"Off you go, then, Private Pulsifer. May the armies of glorification march with ye."
After Newt had driven off, Shadwell thought of something, something that he'd never had the chance to do before. What he needed now was a pin. Not a military-issue pin, which is for the use of, just an ordinary pin, such as you might stick in a map. The map was on the wall. It was old. It didn't show Milton Keynes. It didn't show Harlow. It barely showed Manchester and Birmingham. It had been the Army's HQ map for 300 years. There were a few pins in it still, mainly in Yorkshire and Lancashire, and a few in Essex. But they were almost rusted through. Elsewhere, mere brown stubs indicated the distant mission of a long-ago witch-finder. Shadwell finally found a pin among the debris in an ashtray. He breathed on it, polished it to a shine, squinted at the map until he located Tadfield, and triumphantly rammed the pin home. It gleamed. Shadwell took a step backward and saluted again. There were tears in his eyes. Then he did a smart about turn and saluted the display cabinet. It was old and battered, and the glass was broken, but in a way it was the WA. It contained the regimental silver, the inter-battalion golf trophy, not competed for, alas, in 70 years. It contained the patent muzzle-loading thunder gun of Witchfinder Colonel, "Ye shall not eat any living thing with the blood, neither shall ye use enchantment, nor observe times," Dalrymple. It contained a display of what were apparently walnuts, but were, in reality, a collection of shrunken headhunter heads donated by Witchfinder CSM Horace, get them before they get you, Narker, who'd travelled widely in foreign parts. It contained memories. Shadwell blew his nose noisily on his sleeve. Then he opened a tin of condensed milk for breakfast. If the armies of glorification had tried to march with Newt, bits of them would have dropped off. This is because, apart from Newt and Shadwell, they had been dead for quite a long time. It was a mistake to think of Shadwell, Newt never found out if he had a first name, as a lone nut. It was just that all the others were dead, in most cases for several hundred years. Once, the army had been as big as it currently appeared in Shadwell's creatively edited bookkeeping. Newt had been surprised to find that the Witchfinder army had antecedents as long and almost as bloody as its more mundane counterpart. The rates of pay for Witchfinders had last been set by Oliver Cromwell and never reviewed. Officers got a crown and the general got a sovereign. It was just an honorarium, of course, because you got 9 pence per witch found and first pick of their property. You really got to rely on those 9 pences. And so times had been a bit hard before Shadwell had gone on the payrolls of heaven and hell. Newt's pay was 1 old shilling per year. Footnote. Note for young people and Americans. 1 shilling equals 5p. It helps to understand the antique finances of the Witchfinder Army if you know the original British monetary system. 2 farthings equals 1 halfpenny. 2 halfpennies equals 1 penny. 3 pennies equals a threepenny bit. 2 threepences equals a sixpence. 2 sixpences equals 1 shilling, or bob. 2 bob equals a florin. 1 florin and 1 sixpence equals half a crown. 4 half-crowns equals 10 bob note. 2 10 bob notes equals 1 pound or 240 pennies. 1 pound and 1 shilling equals 1 guinea. The British resisted decimalized currency for a long time because they thought it was too complicated. In return for this, he was charged to keep glimmer, firelock, firebox, tinderbox, or igniferous matches about his person at all times, although Shadwell indicated that a Ronson gaslighter would do very well. Shadwell had accepted the invention of the patent cigarette lighter in the same way that conventional soldiers welcomed the repeating rifle. The way Newt looked at it, it was like being in one of those organizations like the Sealed Knot, or those people who kept on refighting the American Civil War. It got you out at weekends, and meant that you were keeping alive fine old traditions that had made Western civilization what it was today. An hour after leaving the headquarters, Newt pulled into a lay-by and rummaged in the box on the passenger seat. Then he opened the car window, using a pair of pliers for the purpose, since the handle had long since fallen off. The packet of firelighters was sent winging over the hedge. A moment later, the thumbscrew followed it. He debated about the rest of the stuff, and then put it back in the box. The pin was Witchfinder military issue, with a good ebony knob on the end, like a lady's hat pin. He knew what it was for. He'd done quite a lot of reading. Shadwell had piled him up with pamphlets at their first meeting, but the army had also accumulated various books and documents, which, Newt suspected, would be worth a fortune if they ever hit the market. The pin was to jab into suspects. If there was a spot on their body where they didn't feel anything, they were a witch. Simple. Some of the fraudulent witch-finders had used special retracting pins, but this one was honest, solid steel. He wouldn't be able to look old Shadwell in the face if he threw away the pin. Besides, it was probably bad luck. He started the engine and resumed his journey. Newt's car was a Wasabi. He called it Dick Turpin in the hope that one day someone would ask him why. It would be a very accurate historian who could pinpoint the precise day when the Japanese changed from being fiendish automatons who copied everything from the West to becoming skilled and cunning engineers who would leave the West standing. But the Wasabi had been designed on that one confused day and combined the traditional bad points of most Western cars with a host of innovative disasters, the avoidance of which had made firms like Honda and Toyota what they were today. Newt had never actually seen another one on the road, despite his best efforts. For years, and without much conviction, he'd enthused to his friends about its economy and efficiency, in the desperate hope that one of them might buy one, because misery loves company. In vain did he point out its 823cc engine, its three-speed gearbox, its incredible safety devices, like the balloons which inflated on dangerous occasions, such as when you were doing 45 miles per hour on a straight, dry road, but were about to crash because a huge safety balloon had just obscured the view. He'd also wax slightly lyrical about the Korean-made radio, which picked up Radio Pyongyang incredibly well, and the simulated electronic voice, which warned you about not wearing a seatbelt, even when you were. It had been programmed by someone who not only didn't understand English, but didn't understand Japanese either. It was state-of-the-art, he said. The art, in this case, was probably pottery. His friends nodded and agreed, and privately decided that, if ever it came to buying a Wasabi or walking, they'd invest in a pair of shoes. It came to the same thing anyway, since one reason for the Wasabi's incredible MPG was that fact that it spent a lot of time waiting in garages while crankshafts and things were in the post from the world's only surviving Wasabi agent in Nigirizushi, Japan. In that vague, zen-like trance in which most people drive, Newt found himself wondering exactly how you used the pin. Did you say, "I've got a pin and I'm not afraid to use it"? Have pin will travel? The pin slinger? The man with the golden pin? The pins of Navarone? It might have interested Newt to know that of the 39,000 women tested with the pin during the centuries of witch hunting,
29,000 said, ouch. 9,999 didn't feel anything because of the use of the aforesaid retractable pins, and one witch declared that it had miraculously cleared up the arthritis in her leg. Her name was Agnes Nutter.